We welcome back to KPFA Alan Rich, former music director, program director, and folio editor, and later music director of Pacifica with headquarters in New York. Have I covered the extent of your relationships with Pacifica, Alan?
Well, I think you've covered the official titles I had. Of course, one of the things that hasn't changed about KPFA, Will, is that no matter what title you have, everybody seems to be involved in everything around here, which is one of the exciting things about Pacifica and always has been.
To see the station manager sweeping the floor, did you have any of these?
Yeah, exactly, or the music director pushing the transmitter around, something like that.
Yes. How long were you associated with Pacifica?
Well, let's see. I came to KPFA in 1953 and was here until the fall of 1960. So I was here almost 8 years, and then I was with WBAI for another 7 or 8 months in New York before moving on.
And this moving on is to become a music critic of the New York Times.
Yeah, that was a very lucky break that happened about a year and a half ago, Will. I have been since that time one of the five music critics on the Times, and very happy with it.
Well, this is not only an influential paper and position as far as New York is concerned, but I know from personal experience that it's influential as far as the whole country is concerned.
It seems to be that. Sometimes you get the impression at the Times that they're less interested in putting out a newspaper than they are in putting out a daily supplement to the Encyclopedia Britannica. And it's all a little frightening, but terribly important and very exciting.
Are the powers that be of the Times and you yourself, are you aware of your function in relation to the whole country as well as New York when you write, or are you primarily interested in your New York readers?
Well, that's, of course, hard to say. As a music critic, naturally, one of the largest segments of the our public are the people who were at the actual concert under question the night before, and who open their daily paper the next morning before they can express an opinion of their own to find out what one of us thinks about it. So that the New York audience is important in the sense that for New York, the night before, that concert was news. But then on the other hand, the music critic on any newspaper, but especially on a paper like the Times, has an enormous effect on the growth of the whole musical life in the country for the simple reason that he's dealing with people who will be heard everywhere in the country. So that for that reason, we have to think in terms of a national and, for that matter, even an international audience.
Does this dual influence more or less separate itself into daily and Sunday times, or does it carry over pretty much, do you believe, to the operation of the whole week?
Well, of course, the Sunday Times is a different... By the Sunday Times, I presume you mean the drama section.
Yes.
With the... music page and the record,
yes,
reviews and things of that sort. Well, that, of course, is not quite as immediately timely in the sense of dealing with concerts that have taken place during the week. It's more in the nature of a music magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, an awful lot of people all over the country, all over the world for that matter, read the Sunday Times as a kind of weekly cultural magazine that perhaps aren't quite so interested in following the day-to-day events in the daily paper.
What is the role of a great newspaper like the Times in the music life of a community the size of New York? This is a broad question, but
yeah.
Maybe you can break it down for me a bit.
Well, what you mean is, what is the role of the music critic, I suppose?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. Well, there's been quite a lot of talk about that because as we record this program, the newspapers in New York are all shut down by this strike, and there was an article by my boss, Harold Schoenberg, just a week ago about the terrible effect that the lack of reviews in the New York papers is having on the whole concert life. The reason for that is that New York is still, for better or for worse, the center of American musical life. Everything seems to emanate from New York. If you want to ask me whether I think this is a good thing or not, you're perfectly welcome to do so. But in any case, there it is. And any young person giving a concert in New York, especially a debut concert, hiring Town Hall or Carnegie Recital Hall or one of the larger halls, to make his first impact on a public will tell you, quite frankly, that the most important thing that comes out of this concert is the reviews, because the reviews are what the whole future of this performer is based on. The reviews are presumably read by the concert managers who are in charge of national booking, and they are also read, of course, by the public who would come to this person's next concert. And without reviews, the feeling is that the concert exists pretty much in a vacuum. Just the fact that an artist seems to be able to please the public that comes to this concert isn't enough for the future of a career. I'm not at all sure, of course, that this is the healthiest thing to have happen. I believe, perhaps a little too idealistically, that the concert goer should be able to think more for himself rather than depending on the critic, and that there ought to be a better way for a career to be built than just on the word of one or two people who are there in a critical capacity, who themselves might have some passing weakness of or debility of mind that might not make their review particularly reliable on that given night.
You're referring to the concerts occurring in New York that are reviewed by the critics of New York.
Yeah.
Is there any influence on the part of records rather than live performances in shaping the careers of young performers?
Well, a young performer generally doesn't get to make records until he's pretty well launched on a career. This is particularly true in this country. The whole idea of the record having influence on the career of the artist is a very interesting, very fascinating topic, which I think bears more on the impact that European performers have been able to make in this country. For example, when a pianist like Richter comes here for the first time now, he's no longer an unknown because he's made records and they've been heard, and people have also heard him in Europe, of course. As far as the American artist, unless he is well received at his concert, chances are he won't have made recordings unless he's recording for some small local label that probably isn't very well distributed. Mm-hmm. So it's the concert first, generally, and the recording second, except in very, very rare instances.
I'll mention a name here. I'm thinking of a person such as old Bethany Beardsley.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, to a lesser extent, Marnie Nixon or someone like this, whose first opportunities seem to have come about because they made some records of new music.
Well, now you've touched on a very interesting exception there. In the case of these two people, both of them remarkable singers and remarkably talented in very difficult areas. Well, now take Marnie Nixon, for example. She participated in that Webern album that was put out by Columbia.
Yes.
That was the first major recording, I think, that she had made, and she was marvelous in the set. Well, the impetus for that album came because music of Webern was being performed in the Los Angeles area by a group of musicians, most of them connected with studios, that had gotten together to put these things on at various of the small concert organizations, like, for example, the Monday evening concerts.
Mm-hmm.
Bethany Beardsley, the same sort of thing. She sang with the New York Pro Musica. She sang at Princeton, where the influence of Milton Babbitt and other far-out composers had gotten a lot of contemporary music performed. So that in that case, what happened was that the impetus first was to record the music and then to find the people who were able to do this music. Now, this is extremely difficult, abstruse music, the sort of music that you would not be able to get somebody like Lily Pons or Joan Sutherland to record, even though they might be bigger names. So you have to go along with the people who can perform it. Well, in the case of Bethany Beardsley and Marnie Nixon, you had very good people to go along with, and in those cases, their career was made from recordings. You're perfectly right. But those are exceptions. The young pianist who comes into Town Hall make a debut playing a Beethoven sonata, a Liszt group, a Chopin group, the usual soup-to-nuts kind of debut program, generally isn't in that category because he's not the specialist that these other people are.
Now, if you have a person making a certain reputation, establishing a certain reputation through records, does this tend to move into the concert area as well? A person like Bethany Beardsley, is she called upon in New York then for other work because of her records, or is it pretty much isolated into the area of recording and the area of live performance or concerts?
When you say called upon, yes, she's called upon to a certain extent, because if some group wants to put on a performance of contemporary music that requires a soprano, chances are they're going to try to get hold of Bethany Beardsley or one of the other few other singers around New York. By the way, a gal named Dorothy Renzi, who used to live out here, is also very active in New York circles in this particular field in performing contemporary music and is doing very well at it. I just wanted to throw that in as a local note. But the chances are they try to get somebody like this, and that's perfectly true. On the other hand, of course, if Bethany Beardsley wants to put on a concert by herself, she's not called upon to do this. She calls upon a manager or someone who will arrange a concert for her. And in this case, of course, the fact that she is on records is going to help her sell tickets once the concert has been set up. So that, on the one hand, there is the demand from the people who want to perform this kind of music, but it doesn't necessarily help her get more concerts as a solo personality artist. It does help her, of course, once she's gotten a concert date set up to sell more tickets.
To what extent...
Come close to breaking even on the expenses.
Yes. So the reputation rubs off in making her concert appearance more successful. But I assume from your answer that it probably doesn't open wide the gates as far as a flood of opportunities being brought to her.
No, because, let's face it, a singer who specializes in Webern cantatas is not going to get the same flood of offers from people who want to sell a lot of tickets to a concert as someone who makes a reputation singing arias from Johann Strauss operettas.
Well, I took Miss Beardsley because of the Pro Musica experience of her singing 18th century music as well as 20th.
Yeah, that's true.
General. But let's take the other person. Let's take the person that comes into Carnegie Hall or somewhere, Town Hall, and plays an excellent program that is favorably reviewed. Are the doors then open to them?
Well, here's what usually happens. If the review is favorable, the chances are that one of the large concert organizations like Columbia Concerts or Saul Hurock or the National Concerts and Artists Corporation are going to be interested in this person to get hold of him or her and put this person set him up for a nationwide tour of some sort. First thing they will do is to audition the person, because they're not going to take anybody that they haven't heard themselves. Of course, sometimes they already have auditioned the person, because if there's a big groundswell of word of mouth, maybe there'll be somebody from one of these managements there at the concert, the concert in question that was reviewed so well. But chances are no. Chances are they wait for the reviews, and then they set up an audition themselves. Then what usually happens is that somebody gets signed on with, say, the Community Concerts, which is the touring arm of Columbia Concerts, and gets sent around and maybe picks up 2 or 3 months of 4 or 5 dates a week as a first year's tour. This is the way it usually works. If the reviews are really ecstatic, the person may also be interested in trying a second concert that year in New York. And if he can get a booking in a hall, if there's a date available, which is problematic, he may very well try this second concert with the hope on the second concert of selling enough tickets to break even. By the way, we should say here that this first concert has invariably represented an enormous financial loss for even the most successful singer or the most successful performer, for the simple reason that nobody's going to buy tickets to an unknown. They have to wait and be told by us of the press that this person is worth buying tickets for. They get their audience by giving away tickets or by perhaps scheduling an interesting enough program that a few people who want to hear the music will buy tickets, but they're certainly not going to make money on it.
Does this mean then, Alan, that a concert in New York might draw a very small audience and yet for that performer be an exceptionally important event?
Oh, sure.
While perhaps in some other town in the country he might inversely draw a large audience and still the concert not be meaningful in terms of his career.
Well, that's the unfortunate thing that I mentioned before. New York is still the only place where the concert really seems to become meaningful. The responsibility for this, I think, lies to a certain extent with the other musical communities of this country, the large cities, who still, it seems to me, don't offer the proper environment for a person to center himself, say, in San Francisco or Chicago or someplace else, and build a successful career. They have to go to New York. It's the New York reviews that are meaningful. This is not the same as saying that New York has the best music critics. It's just that their position on the Times and the Herald Tribune and the two or three afternoon newspapers that carry reviews is the most important thing that can happen. They're the only newspapers that really seem to carry an awful lot of weight. It's not a good situation. Mm-hmm. It's a very bad situation, but it happens.
Yes. I'm thinking of a tenor that sang with the San Francisco Opera this year and then went to New York and sang this year also, McCracken, who had come from a fairly long period of European singing in opera.
Mm-hmm.
Now, would you say that this man hadn't arrived until he sang in New York, that his career wasn't set, or do you think that his European tour or his European stint was the matter of his establishing a career in opera?
Well, in McCracken's case, the latter is true. McCracken has had a tremendous success in Europe, and he is already someone to reckon with. Interestingly enough, he is one of these people who is no longer really considered an American performer, although he is American, and of course that helps the incidental fact that he is American. But he comes to this country as a big star of Europe, and he's almost, therefore, in the same category as Joan Sutherland. The fact there that he also got marvelous reviews in San Francisco, I presume he did, mm-hmm. I've talked to a number of people who have heard him, will help him considerably, of course, in New York. But that's what I was... McCracken's case is what I was mentioning before when I talked about this kind of groundswell, this kind of grapevine. Everybody in New York is now primed to hear McCracken because word has come from all over Europe and from San Francisco that this guy is great, and he'll have no trouble getting a full house at his debut.
Mm-hmm. Now, I suppose that as far as singers are concerned, this is one avenue of subversion in relation to a New York performance, and that is go to Europe. I'm not so sure this can happen for instrumentalists.
No. Opera singers are a special case here because opera itself is such a tingly sort of thing, and everybody in this country who loves opera keeps very much up to date with what's going on at La Scala and the Vienna Opera and the Paris Opera and Covent Garden, that the grapevine is very, very active in the field of opera. It doesn't happen with pianists or violinists or even string quartets.
There's another area of influence that I was thinking of a few minutes ago that I would like to bring up to you. I think that perhaps I am more influenced when I read the Times by the record reviews than the concert reviews.
Well, you're here 3,000 miles from New York. Obviously, a concert review is interesting to you if it's someone you know or someone who may be coming out here, whereas a record review is more interesting because it's of a product which you yourself can lay your hands on.
Now, you are often occupied with record reviews, or were for a while.
I still am, plenty.
I remember your reviewing of an Italian, I believe it was an Italian RCA History of Music.
Mm, yeah.
And until this day, I must admit I haven't gotten a hold of it, but I insist that I'm going to, primarily because I read the glowing review of this series.
It costs $80, by the way.
Maybe this is one of the reasons. I'm quite interested in knowing how a paper like The Times structures its music department. Do they do it by saying someone is to take care of concerts, someone else record reviews, or how do you fit into the picture?
No, it isn't done that way, Will. There are, as I say, five of us in the music department. Harold Schoenberg is the chief critic, and Ross Parmenter is the music editor. Then there are three of us in the somewhat lower echelon. Ray Erickson, myself, and a fellow named Howard Klein. This happens to be order of seniority, not necessarily mm-hmm. order of quality. The three of us, the three in the lower echelon, are also responsible for record reviewing. Harold and Ross don't do very much. Ross happens to have a particular fascination for Handel, so he does one or two big pieces on Handel a year. But on the whole, the brunt of the record reviewing falls on the three of us. The records come in and are distributed to us, and then we're each of us responsible for an average of a full-size record piece every 2 weeks. In addition to that, of course, all five of us have our regular concert assignments. Harold makes up the schedule every week for what we're going to cover the next week. And so each of us works our 5 days a week. During the height of the season, this can mean that each of us might have as many as 7 or 8 concerts to review, because, of course, on Saturday and Sunday there are concerts in the afternoon as well as in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
So that our job consists, first of all, of reviewing the concerts, and then for three of the five, of reviewing records, and then of handling items that are sort of the news aspect of music. Metropolitan Opera strike, for example, or the Philharmonic strike, or plans for the formation of a new orchestra. Then another thing that we all do interviews, either for the daily paper or sometimes for the music page of the Sunday paper. Those are, well, we set them up at the convenience of the person that we're interviewing. Generally, it's either Harold Schoenberg or Ross Parmeter who assigns us to these interviews and is in charge of deciding where and when they're to be used. So that there's that, the interviews or various think pieces for the main page on Sunday, the news aspect, the record reviewing, and the concert reviewing, all of which manage to keep us fairly busy during the winter. During the summer, when there aren't too many concerts, we have a little bit more spare time. That's when we all write books.
Yes, and do they send you off to New York to cover the festivals?
Or out of New York, off to Europe? Well, not Europe yet. Harold went to Europe 2 summers ago. I hope maybe within the next 20 years I'll get to Europe. I spent a weekend at Tanglewood and a weekend at Marlborough, Vermont, which is a very exciting place.
Mm-hmm.
And last year, the year before this, I spent a weekend at Chautauqua. We do a lot of covering of things out of town in the summertime because that's where a lot of interesting things happen.
Now, you did some coverage on the opening concerts of the Lincoln Center.
Oh, we were all involved with Lincoln Center. It was a real rat race that last month. Everything that happened up there for the month before the hall actually opened was news. The first time the orchestra rehearsed there, the first time the windows were washed, the first time the stage was actually in condition to be used. It was all very exciting. And then when Lincoln Center finally opened, of course, everybody was terribly excited. A new hall, what was it going to sound like, what was it going to look like, all that sort of thing. So we were all involved.
Can you tell us your own impressions of Lincoln Center? Does it measure up to the American New Theater for music?
Well, it may be the American New Theater for music. I think you should rather ask whether it measures up to the best of the American Old Theater for music. Of course, this year, everybody's favorite topic of conversation in New York is Lincoln Center, and especially the acoustics. I think Lincoln Center asked for trouble because even before the cornerstone was laid, they announced that they were going to have the most acoustically perfect hall in the world, so that everybody was primed for them. I don't happen to think the acoustics in Lincoln Center are as bad or as good as a lot of people say they are. It's a different kind of sound, and it's a little hard to get used to. It's bright and hard and clear, and the people who compare it to the sound of an ideal hi-fi set are probably closest to the truth. It certainly doesn't sound like Carnegie Hall or the Philadelphia Academy or the Boston Symphony Hall, which has been, for many years now, the standard of excellence in what a large concert hall should sound like. There are imperfections, certainly, in the sound at the moment, the distribution of the sound, the fact that it sounds so much different from one seat to another, which can be corrected with those clouds that they have hanging up. You've seen pictures of it, I suppose. Everybody has those acoustical...
I haven't seen that, no.
Oh, they have these things in the ceiling. They're called clouds. Actually, they kind of look like bathtubs that can be tilted one way or another.
Oh, yes.
By, mm-hmm. by motors, and they're for reflection and for spreading the sound, and they can be adjusted by just pushing a button. And they've been adjusting them practically from day to day to try to clear up this distribution business.
How large is the auditorium?
The auditorium seats 2,600 people. It's 100 seats smaller than Carnegie Hall.
And is there also some arrangement for chamber music in...
Well, they have a very lovely screen that they put up across the stage that cuts the size of the stage down so that chamber music can be played in front. This year, of course, being as how it's the first season of Philharmonic Hall, everybody wants to play in Philharmonic Hall.
Yes.
Harpsichordists, string quartets, sopranos giving leader recitals, everybody. Now, it's ridiculous to think that a hall this size could have ever been conceived for this kind of a small sound, any more than Carnegie Hall is very often used for string quartets. But, as I say, this year there's a certain glamour in playing in Philharmonic Hall, and I think after this year, the small organizations will go back to Town Hall where they belong. The sound is not very good for small organizations in the hall. It just sounds distant. It should sound distant. The hall is very, very long, and when you're in the back, you're an awful long way from that little tinkly sound on stage. But you can get a prodigious noise out of a full-size symphony orchestra in the hall, believe you me. I think that the most exciting thing about the hall, and the one thing that I think is beyond any controversy, is the comfort. The fact that when you go out for a smoke at intermission, you have these wonderful sweeping promenades to walk around on, as compared to Carnegie Hall, where you were all squeezed into a little narrow corridor, where you just couldn't smoke a cigarette without setting somebody's fur coat on fire.
I shouldn't put you on the spot here.
Well, you haven't really. You know, there's one thing that you haven't asked me about.
What is
that? I'd like to get back to it for a minute. This business about criticism. You've been talking an awful lot about criticism of performers.
Yes.
You haven't touched on the subject of criticism of the music itself, which surprises me a little bit because
That's
they
right.
tell me
especially,
you're a composer.
Especially new music.
Yeah. Don't you want to ask me about that? Because that's...
Well,
that,
I do want to ask you about it.
Of course, that's also a very important part of our
function. I
wasn't
quite... Well, you know, my contact pretty much with the New York Times has... I'd have to look in something like... Well, now, let's put it this way. My contact is very often through the magazine section on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And so I miss many of the coverages that might occur in the daily paper,
mm-hmm.
where I presume a lot is done in terms of concerts of new music.
Yeah, well, let me ask you a more general question then. You are a composer, and this means that you certainly have some hope of your music being played somewhere or other. What is your reaction to adverse criticism of your music, or for that matter, what's your reaction to favorable criticism of your music? Does it mean anything to you?
Well, I think that a composer isn't quite in the exposed position that the performer is in.
Granted.
And he is just so happy to get a performance when he gets it that I don't think he considers, unless he's a particular type of composer that is extremely publicly minded and really aggressive about this, that he doesn't very much consider the reaction.
In other words, this doesn't surprise me at all because I've heard it from a lot of people, but from your standpoint, in other words, music critics aren't all that necessary. You think that music critics are more important for the performer than they are for the composer.
Well, I'm not so sure of that because I think the music critic can be a big help. I think what I'm talking about is the coverage of a single performance of the composition.
Mm.
If the music critic, as I'm sure you would be, would take the time to know the piece by coming to a rehearsal, would look at the score, then attend the concert, and be able to say that the performance was pretty rough of this piece, and the piece has things in it that didn't come out, if this is the case, then, of course, I would certainly be very happy that that critic was there.
Mm-hmm.
But I have an idea that very often the critic is just another one in the audience that's hearing it for the first time without any preparation and doesn't know if the performance is good or bad.
Yeah, well, certainly we do take this side of our work seriously enough to try whenever possible to get hold of the score. As far as coming to rehearsals is concerned, that's awfully hard because we work a pretty tight schedule.
Mm-hmm.
But we do, whenever possible, try to get hold of the score. Are you satisfied yourself with the with the level of music criticism in the country? Do you think that that the man into whose hands you place your fate, or your score, or your invitation to the rehearsal, tends to be a man qualified to judge what you yourself have poured your heart and soul into for a fair period of time?
Well, I think the composer can be very very pleased that good musicians, musicians that are capable of approaching new music with a good degree of knowledge and experience and brain power and good ears, are more and more becoming critics. Mm. I, of course, include you, and I think of the man who's music director at WBAI that was
Eric
on the
Saltzman,
time,
yeah.
Eric Saltzman. And so I think the prospect is much better than it has been.
Mm-hmm.
I think the orientation is much more toward music rather than toward purely performance, and this is marvelous.
Mm. But you don't feel that your music stands or falls on the criticism that it gets in the daily papers?
I don't think the composer feels this, because he's occupied for a heck of a long time writing the piece, you know, and when he's written it, then more or less he's through with it and he's on another piece. And I think he thinks in a little different terms than the than the result of the performance of that work. It might be cumulative. Over the number of years, he might look back and blame the press, like Stravinsky has done for certain things.
Yeah, well, it's curious, of course, that Stravinsky has taken as much time as he has to blame the press, considering that his reputation is secure. How do you, without our help, hope to make your reputation as a composer?
Well, I suppose, I know that you put this in, a direct question to me, and I keep turning it off into a general...
Well, you've had me speaking for the critical profession, now I'll have you speaking for the composing profession.
I see. Well, in the first place, it's parallel, isn't it, to the performer's problem in this country. So many young people go to New York after graduating from college, after being graduated, and they say they're going to New York, where they obviously are planning to become the concert performer or so forth. And perhaps some composers do the same thing. The only place that your music can be heard and make its mark is if you are sitting in New York and getting it done in some of the concerts of new music that take place there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not sure. Do you think that the reason for this is because... is because the concert is going to be reviewed, or do you think the reason is because the instrumentalists to play it are there, or the publishers are there, which might combine with the reviewing, of course?
I think it's more than anything the availability of good musicians, because you can take, after all, you can send a tape from here to a publisher.
Mm-hmm.
Along with a manuscript score, and the chances are, if it's a publisher who's at all interested in new music, he'll take a look at it and listen to it. But one thing that does exist in New York and in Los Angeles and probably nowhere else in the country to this great extent is the enormous availability of really first-rate freelance musicians who have over the years developed this tremendous facility for sight reading. You have good people. Quite a number of them in San Francisco too, but the population isn't as great as it is in Los Angeles, where you have all these studio musicians who like to play hard chamber music after hours to help buy their ticket to heaven, or in New York, where you just have this enormous number of really first-rate string and wind and brass and percussion players who are available and who form these little chamber orchestras that come and go night after night.
I'm thinking of a composer that is at present here in Berkeley, but is an Easterner, is a New Yorker. And thinking of the fact that a new work that he wrote found the problems of performance so great that before that piece was performed, he had already dedicated about $800 of his own money to the fact of its performance. For a New York performance, so it seems quite obvious that a New York performance was meaningful to him.
He probably could have saved some money by dedicating it to a New York performer.
And letting him worry about the performance.
Yeah.
But are you not agreeing then, Alan? Do you think that the reviewer is highly important in terms of new music and the composer.
Well, we live such a day-to-day existence, Will, that I'm, at least speaking for myself now, I have to constantly be told by both composers and performers whether we're important to them at all. As far as the performer is concerned, I guess we are, because this is an established pattern that doesn't seem to be breaking down, that the New York Review makes the performer's career. I don't know the answer to that as far as new music is concerned. I know that I try very hard to write as penetratingly and intelligently as I can on new music, because I think it's terribly important that we speak our piece on new music. But I think it's for you to tell me rather than for me to tell you whether we're important for it or not. I guess we are if we can inculcate into our readers an appetite to hear this piece again. The chances of a new piece of music by a composer unknown in New York being played again awfully soon are, I think, a little less great than the chance of a new performer being heard again in New York, for the simple reason that there's so much new music pouring into New York to be performed. But it can happen. I'm sure that if I wrote a rave review of your quartet that was so violently effusive that it made page one of the Times, there would probably be peace demonstrations in Times Square and everything else to get the thing played again.
Yes, well, I think I'll call on you for that purpose someday.
Call on me to listen. Beyond that,
you have to let the value assert itself here.
Yes, sir.
Are you? I think for your friends that have known you from your KPFA days, that I should ask you this question because it must be in their minds. Are you happy with being a newspaper man? Are you happy with New York? And do you miss KPFA in San Francisco?
Yes, to all three questions, I guess. Certainly I miss KPFA in San Francisco, or I wouldn't be here on my vacation. This is a trip that I paid for out of my own pocket during a time when my immediate financial future is somewhat threatened by this strike, which may go on for quite a while yet. But I decided that I had to come to San Francisco while I was watching the World Series on television and saw those views of those chicken coops from Candlestick Park. At least they were chicken coops, but at least I recognized them. You know, those horrible houses up on the hill.
Yes.
Above the park.
Yeah.
I do miss the Bay Area. I had hoped for a little warmer weather out here for my vacation, but I do think, you know, just as you walk along a dirty, sooty side street in New York, how much nicer it is to live in a city like Berkeley where you can have your own car and find a parking place and live in a nice big house for $85 a month compared to the usual uncomfortable New York apartment. I don't think I'd be happy in New York if I weren't enjoying my work as much as I am and if I weren't making enough money to be able to live comfortably. But I can't deny that despite my basic dislike of the conditions of life in New York, that I have been happy there in what's been happening to me. The Times job itself is superb. I couldn't ask for better working conditions or for a better atmosphere to work in. It, of course, naturally and inevitably has led to a number of other things, freelance writing assignments of one sort or another, which help considerably. I think that this is the only way to live in New York. If it's a choice between being a drudge in New York and being a drudge, a nameless drudge, that is, in New York or somewhere else, I think it's madness to live in New York. And I would have been back in Berkeley a long time ago. But I have to admit that I'm happy the way things are going. My morale is, however, considerably buoyed up by the knowledge that I can hop a plane and be out here in 5 hours.